We've been looking during these sessions at the Christian's relationship to the Old Testament, and that naturally brings up the question of what about military involvement? I suppose after the events of what we call now 9/11, there were many comments made about what happened and what should be done about it. And certainly, as we observe the events of that day, most people would agree that that was a horrible, wicked act that was done. And most people would agree, I think, that the perpetrators of that crime should be brought to justice. Also, it's obvious from reading the New Testament that a nation has the responsibility to defend its citizens against evildoers. And then the question arises, should the Christian join the military and serve his nation by helping rid the world of such murderers? That's the question. When you study the New Testament, it's clear that God says that governments do not bear the sword in vain as a restraint against evil, and the sword is not used to just prick people for being naughty, it is used to execute them with. And so the fundamental question is not whether God desires evildoers to be executed for their crimes, because that is clear from the Bible, but the question is the New Testament Christian to participate in such things? Now, there are four major views among Christians today regarding war. First one is war is preventive war, that such war is legitimate, and that is that you take military action to prevent a worse evil from occurring. Another common view among Christians that would justify participation in war is that just war may be participated in by Christians. And what they mean by this is that there is just cause for war. Never aggression, but only defensive. And that there must be just intent, never revenge or economic gain or promoting of your own ideology. And it must be last resort. In other words, diplomacy and economic pressure must be tried first. And there must be a formal declaration of war. Only governments, not individuals or militias, can exercise this. And for the war to be just by these definitions, there must be limited objectives. Peace is the goal, not the utter destruction of the political or economic institutions of that other country. And there must be limited force, only enough to secure the peace, and total warfare is inappropriate. And then there must be non-combatant immunity. That means you don't make war against civilians, but only against government forces. Another view among Christians is the one called non-resistance. In that one, the Christian does not use physical force to deal with evil in other people, and governments have the God-given authority to execute criminals. And a fourth view is pacifism, and that is that all war is wrong. I believe, from my understanding of the New Testament, that the New Covenant is incompatible with Christian participation in war. The reason I believe this is because of the Christian's relationship to the Old Covenant. You remember the other evening we were looking at that, and Romans 7 makes it clear that the Christian is disconnected from the Old Covenant. It speaks there in Romans 7 of the Christian being made dead to the law through the body of Christ. Hebrews chapter 8, the old covenant vanished away, making room for the new. Galatians chapter 3, the Christian is connected to Abraham, not to Moses. And you cannot mix and match different aspects of two covenants just to suit yourself. You see, there are conflicting commands in the two covenants. In the old covenant, circumcision was mandatory. In the new covenant, Paul said circumcision made a Christian a debtor to keep the entire law. In the Old Covenant, there was death for picking up sticks on the Sabbath day. In the New Covenant, we have the option in Romans 14 to esteem every day alike. In the Old Covenant, there was a strict prohibition of certain foods. In the New Covenant, God makes everything good to be received with thanksgiving. The Old Covenant had a detailed physical temple, detailed ritual in Jerusalem versus an international corporate body in the New Covenant being the temple of God. So you're in either one covenant or the other. No one on earth is under the old covenant today. The old covenant has been made obsolete by the new covenant in Christ, the one that is better. Now there's a contrast in the Old Testament and in the New Testament regarding a saint participating in war. In the Old Testament, saints were blessed for their military action. Abraham, Joshua, David. And in fact, there was what we would call today ethnic cleansing. God commanded his people to go and utterly wipe out certain nations. In a contrast, New Testament saints have a different kind of commands and a different lifestyle. In the New Testament, saints are never commanded to participate in the military, and there are repeated commands of gentleness and kindness and prayer for all, which doesn't fit with participation in military action. In fact, there are specific lifestyle examples. Paul refers to his previous official actions against Christians as murderer. Now, he thought he was serving God and doing what was right, and he had the official blessing of those who were in charge. That did not change the fact that in performing his official duties, he was still a murderer. Jesus and Stephen asked for blessing on those who killed them. And there's a national contrast regarding brotherhood. In the Old Testament, it is national. In the New Testament, it is international. And regarding theology, in the Old Testament, you have a theocratic state. In the New Testament, there is no theocratic state, but instead there's an international body. Also, it's useful to think of the perspective. David, even though he was a man of God, could not build God's temple because he was a man of war. In the New Testament, we are builders of God's house, the spiritual temple. And I think that fits in with not being appropriate to be in the military. In the Old Testament, the focus is earthly commands implemented by force. There was a physical priesthood. There's a physical temple. There are detailed conduct laws. In the New Testament, the focus is on the heart, spiritual commands implemented by persuasion, not by force. There's a spiritual temple, and we are to rise above the letter of the law. And so, in summary, I believe it is impossible to justify military service by appealing to the Old Testament. No one is a participant in the Old Covenant today. And those who say the Christian can participate in preventive war or in just war, they falsely construct their own covenant by making a smorgasbord of the two covenants. I believe, furthermore, that the New Testament is opposed to Christian participation in war. Jesus' explicit statements on how to deal with evil, in contrast to the Old Testament, which said eye for eye and tooth for tooth, in Matthew 5:38-42, Jesus says, turn the other cheek. Don't resist the evil person. Bless those who persecute you. In Matthew 5:43-48, in contrast to the notion of love your neighbor and hate your enemy, the Old Testament commands you were supposed to love your Israelite neighbor. And they were not supposed to seek the peace or prosperity of the Moabite and the Ammonite. Deuteronomy 23:3-6. But the Sermon on the Mount, there is no limitation on who is to be loved and who is to be blessed. And in fact, you're to be positive toward your enemies. Love your enemies. Bless your cursers, the ones who curse you, and pray for your persecutors. And then if you'll notice that in the Good Samaritan story, Jesus expands the definition of neighbor. It's not limited to persons within the boundaries of Israel. He expands the focus. In the Old Testament, how do I deal with a neighbor of mine? In the New Testament, it is how must I be a neighbor to anyone in need, even those despised by my own nation? Furthermore, Jesus' example in refusal to right injustice is instructive. Sometimes when people discuss why it is important in their minds for the Christian to participate in war, their idea is, well, we should help deal with the injustice in our world. Jesus' example was that he did not do that as he was here on this earth. Luke 12, verses 13 to 59, there was an Israelite who was complaining about his brother that did not properly divide the inheritance with him. Now that is an injustice. And Jesus never lifted a finger to help him with that problem. Instead, he used that episode as a platform to teach a heavenly attitude instead of an earthly one. And if you glance at the passage, you'll find that he was teaching a heavenly attitude regarding hoarding in verses 15 to 21, regarding trusting in God's provision, verses 22 to 34, regarding focusing on being ready for the Lord's return in 35 to 48, and also regarding the recognition that Jesus' teaching will actually bring division of closest earthly ties in 49 to 53, and then towards settling disputes out of court in 57 to 59. You see, Jesus used the occasion to do something higher and better. And that's what we need to be doing too. We're not to be going around trying to fix up everything that's going wrong. Instead, we use that occasion to deal with something that is much more important and at the spiritual roots of what's going on. Luke chapter 13, verses 1 to 5. Pilate had committed an atrocity in mingling the blood of the Galileans with their sacrifices, and Jesus used that situation not to try to correct Pilate, not to try to rally people against that foolish thing that he did, but to use it to teach immediate repentance in a world where death can overtake you at an unexpected moment. Now, the importance of Jesus' example is that the counsels that Jesus gives regarding not using violence cannot be understood apart from his commands to follow me. They are connected. Jesus is not just saying one thing and doing something totally different. You can see his action here is focused on the deeper things, the spiritual issues. Now, how is Jesus our example in this? I want you to turn to Isaiah chapter 53. Now, I want to give you a little bit of background regarding ancient warfare. And that is that in ancient warfare, the soldiers were paid by taking plunder from those who were slain. You went out to battle, and the way you got paid was winning the war. And when you won the war, the other side that got killed, you went and gathered up all their stuff. That's how you got paid. Now keep that in mind in relation to Isaiah 53. Verse 12. It's talking about how Jesus is going to get rewarded. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil or the plunder with the strong. Because he poured out his soul into death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bore the sin of many and made intercession for transgressors. When it says of Jesus, he will divide the spoil with the strong, or the plunder with the strong, that is a military metaphor. He is being rewarded as a military victor. Now, how did Jesus merit that kind of honor? It was not by pursuing an enemy to death, but instead by offering himself for death. It was not by trumpeting his own righteousness as better than the transgressors, but by being counted as a transgressor. It was not by blasting the sins of evil people upon their own heads, but by bearing the sins of the wicked and interceding for them. In other words, what are his tactics like? They are the exact opposite of what we normally call fighting. Now, what Jesus is doing is what someone has termed reverse fighting. That's what he's doing. And that is what he is calling us to do. Reverse fighting. In other words, the way of Christ and those who follow him is loving service and vulnerable suffering. And Christ's commands are his battlefield directives for those who enlist with him. It is the opposite of what the world calls fighting. It is a real battle using different methods and tactics that are required by our holy captain in what he describes in holy war language. Now, why don't Christians see this? Well, I think one of the reasons is they think it isn't going to work. I mean, it might work for a nasty neighbor where the losses aren't too great. But for a nuclear enemy like Russia, well, we're not sure. You see, most Christians look back at the Old Testament and they believe that Hezekiah did the right thing in trusting God against the Assyrians under the threat of Sennacherib. But many Christians do not believe that the God who raised Christ from the dead can be trusted if Hitler threatens. Now, Christians must obey God, whether regarding their neighbor or an attacking army. In fact, we never have a guarantee of physical deliverance. Now, even in the Old Testament, saints knew that, didn't they? Three saints said to one man who threatened them once, "Our God is able to deliver us, but if he doesn't, we still won't bow to your image." Now, the peacenik views won't work either, because they trust in their techniques and political means rather than God's resurrection power. You see, Jesus was the greatest practitioner of nonviolence and love the world has ever seen, and yet what happened to him? From a human standpoint, his enemies destroyed him. But it's only because God resurrected Jesus was his cause salvaged. If he had stayed in the grave, that would have been the end of it. Now that is a clue for us. You see, Jesus is not asking us to do what works. That's where people get lots of confusion in their lives. They say, "Well, yes, but this works." I've had people say that to me again and again in relation to whether Jesus Christ and his word is sufficient. And they'll say, "Yes, we've got to add other things like we do because that works." You know what? That proves nothing at all. Abraham went into Hagar so that he could have a son, and guess what? It worked. You know what God said? "It doesn't count. Get him out of here." And so Jesus is not asking us to do what works. He is asking us to trust him and obey. And that may mean that our success is dependent on resurrection, just like it was for Christ. You see, the kind of love that Christ demands is the outgrowth of resurrection faith that trusts God to vindicate his ultimate purpose. And Jesus is our example. He was completely submissive to the will of the Father rather than defend himself or protect himself. He was unmovable instead of letting somebody else dictate what he would do. Furthermore, I believe the teaching of the epistles makes it clear that the Christian should not participate in the military. The Christian action toward enemies, Romans 12, "On your part, live peaceably with all men. Leave vengeance to the Lord. If your enemy hungers or thirsts, provide for his needs." Now, that is the exact opposite of what you do on the battlefield. If your enemy hungers or thirsts, you try to make sure he really feels the pinch. That's how battlefield tactics work. In fact, you will do things to make it hard for him. You'll blockade his ports. You'll disrupt his supply lines. Romans 12, "By good deeds make your enemy ashamed. Let the Lord avenge instead of taking vengeance." Battlefield tactics don't wait for that. And sometimes people say, "Well, yes, that's talking about your personal enemies. You know, those soldiers over there, they aren't your personal enemies." Oh, that forces a dichotomy between two aspects of your life. You have your personal life and your official life. You know what Christ demands? He demands lordship in your personal life, doesn't he? And in your official life. It's not one time you're one person and one time you're somebody else. And besides, in battlefield situations, your official enemy soon becomes your personal enemy. When he's 10 feet away with a bayonet that's headed right for your stomach, I would say he's your personal enemy, wouldn't you? And then Romans 12 and Romans 13, there is a pronoun shift between the two. In Romans 12, it is the pronoun of the first person, we and us, and you, that kind of thing. In Romans 13, it is they. Let me just glance through that just a little bit. Romans 12, as you glance down through it, you can see these are directives that he is giving to believers. The general directives to believers. And so the commands are in terms of you. When you get to chapter 13, it talks about what these authorities do and how they do not bear the sword in vain. There's a pronoun shift. So I believe that really it doesn't say much about I or we in verse 12 as much as it's referring to you. The Christian attitude toward those around him is supposed to be an attitude of love. I would challenge anyone who believes in just war or preventive war for the Christian to ask any military person how he fulfills 1 Corinthians chapter 13 on the battlefield. Ask him. Find out. The teaching in the epistles on prayer, 1 Timothy 2, verse 1. Intercessions are to be made for all men. Now imagine as a Christian soldier on the battlefield saying this, O Lord, bless those soldiers in the opposing army. Give them skill in their work. Protect them from danger. Enable them to respond the gospel before I attempt to blast them into eternity. Contradictory. The idea of peace in the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14, pursue peace with all people. 1 Peter 3, 11 to 13, pursue peace with meekness in the context of being mistreated by evil persons, and God is against evildoers. Gentleness. 1 Timothy chapter 6, instead of fleshly strife, verses 3 to 5, or greed for money, verses 6 to 10, pursue love, patience, gentleness, verse 11. And instead of carnal fighting, fight the good fight of faith, verse 12. Notice, you have two different kinds of battles here. The fight of faith and carnal fighting. And then 2 Timothy 2, 24 to 26, you're to be gentle to all, humbly correcting opposers, if possibly God will grant them repentance, that they may escape the snare of the devil. Imagine trying that on the battlefield. Galatians 5, verse 23, gentleness is a fruit of the Spirit. And Philippians 4, verse 5, gentleness is to be known to all men. Now notice this. The preventive war and just war ideas have no explicit New Testament support. They always appeal to the Old Testament while ignoring or explaining away the explicit contrast in the New Testament. I mean, a similar approach could be used to use the Old Testament to advocate polygamy and slavery. Also, I believe that the New Testament commands that we have would make military service disobedience to Christ. Now, in a military situation, military people understand this. Failure to follow orders is a serious offense. The New Testament teaches love and patience toward all. And who is giving that command? It is somebody that is above all of the military commanders of this earth. And when they say do something different, you need to follow the supreme commander. Now, pacifism says all war is wrong. But that contradicts Romans 13, where God says he gives the sword so that evildoers can be restrained. And that's the government's job. And I think the New Testament makes it clear that the Christian is not to participate in that particular job. And that leaves what we call non-resistance as the best alternative. You see, what we have here is two kingdoms. You know, when Jesus was before Pilate, the foundational idea is two kingdoms. Jesus said, "If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, but now my kingdom is not from here." Now, Pilate was God's servant. That's clear from Romans 13. And Pilate had the power to use the sword. But Jesus said, "You have no power except what the Father gave." And God gave Pilate the power to execute, but he used that power in the wrong way to kill Christ. Now remember, the Christian is not in a fleshly battle. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 to 6. He says there, "The weapons of our warfare are not carnal." But mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Now that's talking about in the church there, but notice how the weapons of the Christian are. They are arguments of moral and spiritual character to defeat false ideas. They are not fleshly in terms of using force on other people. Now notice the context of these verses. He appeals to the gentleness of Christ, verse 1, and a contrast to those who think Paul walks according to the flesh, verse 2. And verse 3, "We are in the flesh," that means we're still walking around here like this, "but we do not fight according to the flesh," verse 3. Also, you might like to turn to Ephesians chapter 6. In Ephesians 6 talks about the armor of God for the Christian. And it's very clear this is spiritual armor, not physical armor. He explicitly says in Ephesians 6, he says, "Our warfare is not against flesh and blood." Now that's clearly not physical, but spiritual. In other words, participation in ordinary war is not in view here. Flesh and blood is precisely what you fight against in the army. Now, the very armor that is given for the Christian would make him a terrible soldier if he used it on the battlefield. Waist girded about with truth. A very important part of military operations is deception. You want to make the enemy think you're going to attack here when you're going to attack somewhere else so that he doesn't have forces over there. That is an important part of military strategy. Breastplate of righteousness. You know, even in a supposedly just conflict, it is difficult to maintain that breastplate of righteousness in every situation. And then notice verse 15. "Your feet are be shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace." Imagine trying to implement this while the enemy is attacking, or trying to present the gospel of peace to him after you've slaughtered half of his unit. And verse 16, you're to use the shield of faith. In other words, use that when you're up against tanks or bullets. Verse 17, the word of God is the primary offensive weapon. How would you like that one? Telling your commander, "Forget it, I'm not going to lug around that M16. I've got this. It's so much better." I believe that stewardship of the gospel precludes being in the military. You see, money and justice and physical safety for others is not sufficient reason for joining the military. But we are to be stewards of the gospel, and if you join the military, you're going to have problems presenting the gospel to the people around you, and particularly to the people on the opposing side. In fact, military involvement is an impediment to effective witnessing. You see, if you are a conscientious objector to military service and you believe in non-resistance as taught in the New Testament, sometime you'll be confronted by the evils that your country may be involved in as they participate in war, and you can say, you know what? I don't participate in those things because of what Jesus taught and how Jesus lived. I believe that his life and his testimony and what he taught his disciples teaches us to be kind and loving to everybody regardless of their nationality. And then you're free to witness. You see, our desire must be to please the heavenly king, not to have allegiance to the earthly kings. We are to honor earthly kings, but not have allegiance to them. There is a difference, because that means we will not be obedient when it conflicts with the Bible. Now, let's look a little bit at a little history of warfare. The early Christian position was opposed to Christians participating in the military. And Augustine came up with this just war theory based on pagan philosophy and then Christianized it. It's interesting to notice, though, that penance was required for soldiers. In other words, they had to do something to make up for the bad things they'd done. And in around 225 A.D., a man lived called Hippolytus, and he comments on who cannot be baptized. Here's the list: gladiator, huntsman, priest of idols, soldier who has authority must be told not to execute men. If he is ordered to do it, he shall not. He must not take military oath. The magistrate must be denied. If a baptized person joins the army, let him be cast out, for he has despised God. And harlots and sodomites. Now, it's just interesting, when you look down through that list, the kind of people he includes, and I include soldiers with them. The Council of Nicaea was called by the unbaptized military commander, Constantine. And before Constantine, there was severe persecution against the Christians. And Eusebius, the historian, wrote an article called In the Praise of Constantine, where he commended him on how he had blessed the church. But Canon 12, that would be like Article 12 in the Council of Nicaea, said this: a soldier shall be excommunicated for 10 years. Now, isn't that interesting? You have all these conflicting things going on. In their early ministry, both Martin Luther and Ulrich Zwingli advocated non-resistance. And later they compromised and insisted on the union of church and state. Listen to this by Luther. He wrote a letter to his opponent, Johann Eck. Quote, "You say that I would give room to the peace breakers and murderers because I have taught that a Christian should abstain from violence and should not fight to recover his belongings of which he was robbed. Why do you not rebuke Christ who has taught this?" End of quote. In 1520, he wrote another book, a booklet rather, called Why the Pope's Books Have Been Burned. And his 24th reason was this, quote, "Because the Pope teaches that it is right for a Christian to meet violence by violence, contrary to Christ's teaching, who says, whoever will take thy coat, let him have thy cloak also." But later on, Luther advocated the vicious murder of both peasants and Jews. And Hitler, that is Adolf Hitler, loved to quote Luther in his statements against the Jews. If you go to a Holocaust museum, you will probably find somewhere in that museum a quote by Hitler of Luther's horrible statements regarding how the Jews should be killed. Ulrich Zwingli, in 1522, wrote this, quote, "Considered from the Christian point of view, it is by no means right to have a part in war. According to Christ's teaching, we should pray for those who despitefully use us and persecute us, and if an aggressor smite us on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." End of quote. And then in a large book published in 1523, Zwingli said this, quote, "Christ commands that we should not go to law nor engage in carnal strife, but if one take away our coat, let him have our cloak also, and he has taught this by his own example as well. He also forbids all oaths." End of quote. And later on, Zwingli radically changed. He personally participated in war, and he died on the Kappel battlefield in 1531. Johannes Oecolampad was a Zwinglian reformer in Basel, and he later renounced pacifism. He wrote in 1524, quote, "How can a Christian approve of lawsuits and war? The approval of war among Christians is a doctrine of devils. Christians abhor hatred and war. Or show me a war that is waged in love. What should we say about those whose life work consists of shedding blood? We are bidden to give our life for the brethren and to consider even our enemies as brothers. But we go to war and wound and kill those whom we have never known, yea, who may have done us some good service. How is it that there are so many who make less of taking the life of a man than of killing a goose?" End of quote. The Anabaptist, Conrad Grebel, wrote in September of 1524 to a Thomas Munster who had taken up the sword, quote, "The gospel and those who accept it are not to be protected with the sword, neither should they thus protect themselves. True believing Christians are as sheep in the midst of wolves. They must be baptized in anxiety and trouble, tribulation, persecution, suffering, and death. They must be tried in the fire and must reach the fatherland of eternal rest, not by overcoming bodily enemies with the sword, but by overcoming spiritual foes. They use neither the worldly sword nor engage in war, since among them taking human life has ceased entirely, for we are no longer under the old covenant." End of quote. Now notice how he emphasizes that we are no longer under the old covenant. Michael Sadler, quote, "The government using the sword to punish and put to death the wrongdoers and to guard and protect the good is an appointment of God outside the perfection of Christ. In the law of the old covenant, the sword is ordained against wrongdoers for punishment and death, and to exercise it, the worldly governments are appointed." End of quote. He's admitting that governments have this job, but he says the Christians do not have that job. And then in discussions at Frankenthal in the Palatinate between the representatives of the Reformed State Church and the Swiss Brethren, the Brethren spokesman said this, quote, "You say that a Christian could be a magistrate and punish wrongdoers with the sword. We cannot accept this without proof from Christ and the apostles. We confess that the magistracy, according to Paul's teaching, Romans 13, is ordained of God, but that a Christian may serve in such an office to exercise vengeance by the sword. For such teaching, we demand scriptural evidence. All believers are appointed to the example of Christ. His apostles have neither engaged in war nor used the sword for punishment, but have manifested love toward enemies as well as friends. You say that the peace of Christ should be within the heart of the believer, but that he could nevertheless engage in war if he is asked to do so. We do not find an apostolic example that would show." End of quote. Notice the burden of proof is properly put on those who advocate force. Show us from the New Testament. And there is a thundering silence. They cannot find one clear teaching in the New Testament that shows the Christian should use force against the enemies. It's interesting to notice that the Anabaptist groups that abandoned non-resistance, what happened to them? A fellow named Balthasar Hubmaier wrote treatises trying to convince his brethren against non-resistance. And he soon had a large congregation. But those who rejected non-resistance showed little ability to endure persecution. Hubmaier's Waldhut congregation promptly accepted the Catholic creed when the Austrian army repossessed the city. You see, when the army came in that was Catholic and repossessed the city, they said, okay, we'll take it. And when persecution came, the Waldhut congregation soon became extinct. According to those who have studied this, within a few years after Menno Simon's death, 1536, all such groups became extinct. Only those who taught non-resistance, namely the Mennonites and the Hutterian Brethren, survived. It's interesting. What about some techniques and attitudes regarding war? There were changes that occurred down through history. In the 1100s, the Crusades was an opportunity to divert the knights from fighting among themselves and go do something else. Then they had gunpowder and cannon, and that rendered walled cities and knights and armor obsolete. Then you had these dynastic monarchies, and you didn't have any longer just saints, supposedly, fighting against the heathen. And the Reformers led religious wars in contrast to the Anabaptists. And then something came along called universal conscription. Napoleon was the first one to require everyone to join the military. And everyone, in a sense, everyone of a certain age. By World War I, this was universal among the nations. Now, it's interesting to notice some things that happened in World War II. Franklin D. Roosevelt, President of the United States, shifted in his stance regarding the bombing of civilians. In 1939, after the Nazi bombing of civilians, FDR said, quote, "The ruthless bombings from the air of civilians in unfortified centers of population has profoundly shocked the conscience of humanity. I am therefore addressing this urgent appeal to every government which may be engaged in hostilities publicly to affirm its determination that its armed forces shall in no circumstances undertake the bombardment from the air of civilian populations or of unfortified cities." End of quote. And Winston Churchill said in 1940, quote, "His Majesty's government have made it clear that it is no part of their policy to bomb non-military objectives, no matter what the policy of the German government may be. In spite of the wanton and repeated attacks of the German Air Force on undefended towns in Poland, Norway, France, Holland, and Belgium, His Majesty's government steadily adhere to this policy." End of quote. However, but in 1940, later on in 1940, the RAF, the Royal Air Force of Britain, began aerial raids on German industrial cities. And in 1942, the RAF began obliteration bombing, an attempt to terrorize the German people and reduce their will to resist. And in 1943, the U.S. joined in obliteration bombing. You see what happened there? They had some principle to start with, but expediency, they changed their minds and adopted the tactics of the enemy, who was regarded as the evil one. In the World War II event in the European theater, there was a city of Germany called Hamburg, and that city experienced what is called a firestorm, where it was bombed out in the middle, and the fires that started were so extensive that it produced a tremendous heat column rising up, and as that heat, hot air rose up rapidly, air moved in from the outside to fill the vacuum and blew more material into the fire, which made it hotter, and you have what's called a firestorm. And the Allies deliberately created a firestorm at Dresden, where many, many civilians were killed. Now, here's some objections that people make when you say we believe the Christian should not be in the military service. Somebody said this, "Well, Abraham, without specific direction by God as an individual, arranged personal military operation and rescued Lot, slaughtered kings, and was rewarded." First of all, the claim that he did it without specific direction by God is an argument from silence. He did it. Maybe God gave him specific direction. But the second thing is, Abraham was in the Old Testament, and he did not have the New Testament commands that we have. Someone else says, or maybe the same person, "Jesus refused to passively receive injustice." You know, Jesus, when slapped, gave an answer. And I believe the reply to that one is this. He is the King of Glory confronting a subject. He did not move to decapitate the offender. Well, what about this? Paul used Roman citizenship and received protection from the Roman army. Paul received safe travel by soldiers. Paul demanded public exoneration after Philippian beating. And notice what we need to learn. Justice afforded by human government is not in conflict with the Sermon on the Mount. You see, utilization of governmental restraint of evil powers is vastly different than killing the enemy as the role of the Christian. Some people have said something like this: the early church was opposed to military service not because of killing, but because of identity with Caesar, worship, or idolatry. If somebody tells you that, tell them, read Tertullian. Read some of those early documents in the first two centuries. And there are many references to objections to acts of violence against other human beings. For example, Tertullian: We willingly yield ourselves to the sword. So what wars would we not be both fit and eager to participate, even against unequal forces, if in our religion it were not counted better to be slain than to slay? Well, what about believing soldiers in the New Testament? John the Baptist didn't tell the soldiers to leave the army. That's what some people love to say. You know, John the Baptist was still operating in an Old Testament situation, and soldiering was an honorable occupation in the Old Testament. And so, for John to make such statements at this point would have been inappropriate. The law and the prophets are until John. Then something new came. He that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than John, Jesus said. Well, Peter didn't tell Cornelius to leave the army. Again, that's an argument from silence. The point of that passage is not whether a person should be in the military or not. It's talking about salvation for the Gentiles. Maybe in later discussions he did leave. Well, what about the two swords passage? You remember where Jesus said, anybody have swords? They said, we have two. He said, that's enough. Well, it could not mean that two swords were sufficient against a great multitude. I think the best explanation is this. Jesus set up a situation where clearly defense would seem justified. I mean, what situation could you think of would be better than this? The most valuable person in the universe is walking right there in the earth. The most wise person in the universe is there. The only morally perfect man is there. The greatest benefactor of the world is there. And the opponents are whom? A bunch of thugs operating at the behest of viciously jealous men. Now, wouldn't that be an appropriate time to defend this person? You know what he does? He forbids it and gives an object lesson. Put your sword away, and then he heals the enemy's ear. That's powerful. I think Jesus deliberately created an object lesson to say, this is not the way you do things. Love your neighbor in yourself, somebody says. Oh, that's a quote from the Old Testament. And so that's commandment where the Old Testament saints participated in war. And obviously, in the Old Testament, neighbor did not include those national enemies who fought against Israel. They weren't defined that way. But in the New Testament, Jesus addressed a lawyer who wanted to excuse himself and escape responsibility, and he said, who's my neighbor? So he told the Good Samaritan story, and the question at the end was, who is neighbor to the man who fell among thieves? And the lawyer conceded that it was the one who had mercy on him. And Jesus said, you go act the same way. In other words, he changed the focus from who is my neighbor to who can I be a neighbor to? And that is, whoever is in need, you be a neighbor to him, regardless if he is despised by your own nation. Well, somebody will say things like this. Well, loving your enemies is something you're to do to your personal enemies. Now, the enemies of state or criminals are not your personal enemies, and so that doesn't apply to them. Oh. Well, let's try this out on your theories. So do you mean to say that when Jesus says pray for your enemies and bless your enemies, it is only for your personal enemies? Well, first of all, what do you do with the scriptures that say we're supposed to pray for all men? And also, let's try this. Suppose your argument is true. Suppose these passages about loving your enemies are only for your personal enemies, not for these other people out there, like the enemies of state. Well, then, let's suppose that some night a man comes into your house to assault your wife, would that be a personal enemy or not? According to the definitions of most of these people, it certainly would be a personal enemy, yes? And so that would be one to show love to. You see, but the just war advocates, they're quick to say you should have self-defense for such a situation. You see how the arguments they use are inconsistent. Well, somebody's going to say this. There's a dual standard going on for believers and unbelievers. The believers cannot participate in war, and the unbelievers can. The question really here is the morality of execution. Clearly, execution is not morally wrong, because God frequently executed men directly. He killed Onan. He killed the firstborn in Egypt. He had the company of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram go alive down into the pit. Aaron's sons who offered strange fire, God killed them. He struck Nabal, the unnamed prophet that was killed by a lion. God was the instrument of that. The entire Assyrian army. Herod was attacked by worms. You know, God can kill people directly. So it's not morally wrong for people to be executed. Secondly, God can command men to perform the execution. Genesis chapter 9 says, whoever kills a man must be killed by man. Joshua was given commands to go in and utterly slaughter all the people of Jericho. There were death penalties for murder and for kidnapping, as we saw in Exodus chapter 21. And so God instituted that certain people carry those out. Romans 13, the government is instituted by God to kill evildoers. And so the specific question, or the central question, is whether God authorizes a specific person to execute someone. That's the issue. And God's pattern is assign certain jobs to certain people and forbid those for other people. That's his pattern. For example, in the Old Testament priesthood, the priests were to serve the priestly functions, to offer the incense. And others were forbidden. And King Uzziah was greatly blessed of God, and he thought, well, if I can do all these other things with God's blessing, I can do offerings with God's blessing. I can offer incense. And he wanted to go into the temple, and the priest tried to keep him from doing it. He went in anyway with incense, and God struck him with leprosy. You see what God was saying? I gave that job to the priests. You're not to do it, and I mean it. In New Testament, men are assigned eldership and leadership in the church assembly, and women are forbidden to be teachers or authorities over men in the assembly. God gave one assignment. God gave another assignment. In the Old Testament, God rewarded unbelievers for participation in war to accomplish his judgments. For example, Ezekiel chapter 29, verses 18 to 19, Nebuchadnezzar is rewarded for his hard work in beating up Tyre. And God's reward was the wealth of Egypt. And this would come through military conquest. Isn't that interesting? God says, you can have Egypt's stuff as wages for the hard work you did in beating up Tyre. Now, people would say, that isn't just war. Performance of tasks that are in a forbidden sphere constitute sin. Now, that concept is clear to any military person. It is a serious offense for some soldier to forsake a safe post and go to some place that is dangerous raid against the enemy. You can't say, well, I think this other job is more important. I'm going to just let this go. I'm going to go over here and do this marvelous, dangerous thing at great risk, and I'll win glory. You do that, you're in big trouble with your commanders because you were assigned a different place. People always ask, well, what if someone attacks your wife? You know, the saints overcome by loving not their lives to the death. Revelation 12, verse 11. I would say this. Get in that fellow's way while you let your wife escape. And we may need to die. But the scripture gives it clear what we should do and what we shouldn't do. We're to be like a lamb in the midst of wolves. And we don't know what God will do to protect us if we trust in him. Somebody's going to say, well, if you don't defend your wife, that means you love that evil person more than you love her. You know what? That same kind of argument could be used against God himself to say, Why doesn't God defend the helpless Christians in Indonesia from murder and torture at the hand of Muslim terrorists? Does God love the terrorists more than he loves the Christians? You see, that argument doesn't work. The scripture teaches we are to be sheep among wolves, counted as sheep for the slaughter, and nowhere are the sheep directed to defend other sheep against wolves. And interestingly enough, Jesus said, "He who does not hate his father, mother, wife, children, and his own life cannot be my disciple." Interesting. It shows our obedience to Christ must be stronger than any earthly tie. Well, somebody's going to say, well, you know, God expects us to do our part to defend our family, and failure to do so is irresponsible or even sinful. Notice this. God expects us in all areas of life to do what we can physically to meet a need unless something within our ability contradicts one of his commands. Taking up deadly force in defense of your family contradicts many of the New Testament commands. Now, it's interesting that Christ's demand of higher allegiance than allegiance to wife or mother is very interesting in relation to the notion of disobeying Christ in order to protect your family. You might like to look at Matthew 10, 34 to 39. You see, the question is not so much whether we're able to do something, but whether we're obedient to God. John Newton said one time, "Some doors are open not to be walked through, but to be refused." It's a very good statement. A man named Dietrich Bonhoeffer participated in an assassination plot to kill Adolf Hitler because Hitler was such an evil man, causing so many evil effects for many, many people. And some people would say that Bonhoeffer was right in doing what he could to stop Hitler. But the answer is, it was not right if he had to disobey the New Testament in order to do so. That's the answer. You see, we've got to get back to the Bible. We've got to get back to the New Testament, the rules of the New Covenant, the things that God, our commander, tells us to do, and stick by that. Now I want to list for you some reasons why I believe the Christian should not be a participant in the military. Some years ago, back in, I guess it was about 6 years ago, a friend of mine came to visit me. And he said to me, "Well, what are you going to be preaching on or speaking on your next tour?" So I mentioned some things, and one of the things I mentioned was non-resistance. Well, he wasn't from Anabaptist background at all, and he didn't know what that was. So I told him a little bit, and I said, "Would you like to know what my reasons are that I believe the Christian should not be in the military?" He said, yes, he would. Now, it turned out that he had been a former medic in the U.S. Army, and he had been stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So it was very interesting to talk to him about this. And what happened was that he agreed with all my major points, and he gave me more points besides because he knew things that went on in the military that I didn't necessarily know. So let me tell you what I believe about this. Why is it that a Christian should not be in the military? Well, first of all, the whole picture here is that participating in the military will be destructive to your Christian character. And first of all, you will experience that at boot camp. At boot camp, you voluntarily participate in a program that is designed specifically to systematically destroy something good in your character. And the thing that is systematically destroyed is the God-given reluctance to kill other human beings. In other words, killing is not natural. It must be taught. At the Battle of Gettysburg, now that's an American Civil War battle, here are statistics. There were 27,000 muskets left by the dead and dying. But something was very strange. 90% of those that were left by the dead and dying, 90% of those muskets were loaded. Even though it takes 95% of your time to load a musket and only 5% of your time to fire it. Now that is not what you would expect. In fact, over 50% of those muskets had multiple loads, and one musket had 23 loads in it. Now what's going on there? It was that at the moment of truth, the soldier couldn't bear to pull that trigger. So he lowered his gun, loaded it again, and lifted it again. And he did that until he died. In other words, he could stand shoulder to shoulder, he could be brave, but he couldn't bear to just shoot those people out there. In World War II, there was research that was done by Army Brigadier General Marshall, and they found by doing research and asking soldiers what they actually did on the battlefield in World War II, individual riflemen, they found out that only 15 or 20% could bear to shoot at an exposed enemy. Now that is a huge problem for the U.S. Army. Only 15 or 20% of your riflemen can do what they're supposed to be doing from a military standpoint. And so they begin to fix the problem. I mean, that's like having librarians only 15 or 20% can read. By the Korean War, they'd worked on it, you see. The number rose to 55%. And by Vietnam, over 90% were ready to shoot at an exposed enemy. They learned techniques on how to teach men to kill. And when you go to boot camp, that is what you'll be taught. And to do that, they have to do things to systematically destroy the reluctance that God put in your heart to shoot another human being. How do they do it? They do it by brutalization, loss of individuality, verbal and physical abuse, endless exercising, running with heavy packs, and the purpose is to break down your existing values and accept violence as a way of survival. They do it by classical condition. Have you ever heard of Pavlov's dogs? Classical conditioning works like this. Pavlov took some dogs, and every time before he fed them some meat, he rang a bell. Then he fed them meat. Just did that every time. So then he just rang the bell without bringing the meat, but the dogs still salivated. The sound of the bell said, meat is coming, and his system got ready. You see, classical conditioning, they associate killing with a pleasurable activity. And then they do something called operant conditioning. And that is the repeated stimulus response. So you do it automatically. Now, operant conditioning is not necessarily bad. For example, whenever you get into an airplane and fly somewhere, when someone else is a pilot, you hope that he's had some operant conditioning. The guy gets in a simulator, and he's flying that aircraft by simulator. He's not really an airplane, but he's getting all these things as if certain things happen. Okay, your engine died. What do you do? And so he's sweating like crazy, figuring out what to do. And, you know, he put him through all kinds of tests. Practice, 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 practice. When this happens, here's what you do. This happens, here's what you do. You practice and practice and practice, so you do it without thinking. So that when your engine really dies, like, how was it? A few months ago, there was that pilot who was carrying a load of passengers out of New York City or somewhere, I think it was New York City, LaGuardia Airport, and a couple geese flew into his engines and both engines died. He knew what to do. And he laid that airplane right down the Hudson River and nobody was lost. And so, in World War II, they trained soldiers by giving them bullseye targets to shoot at. You know what they do now? They have pop-up man-sized targets. So that target pops up, bang! You see? In other words, it's not just shooting at a bullseye, there's a target. And so you get this stimulus response, so that you shoot reflexively to kill. And then you have role models. These sergeants are violent and aggressive drill sergeants. Now, I want to illustrate this from some books I've read. One of the things I've done to prepare for this talk is read biographical accounts regarding war. And every time I read one of these biographical accounts, I get more reasons for why the Christian should not participate in it. You know, there's glamour that some people paint, the glamour of the military. That's the picture that's painted. You'll go see the world. You drive these big machines. You do all this and do all that. But read biographical accounts of war and you find out how horrible it really is. Notice, in relation to this thing of teaching people to kill, what this person said. After a frustrating night, the men made comments regarding their new mission. And here's the quote. "We're Pavlov's dogs. They condition us through rules, through repeatedly doing things that have no purpose." He laughs. "They probably knew at midnight we would just spend the next 5 hours driving around aimlessly. They know it just makes us mad and gets us keyed up to do something." End of quote. Here's another one. He has a point. Despite another night of sleeplessness, spirits are soaring. One of the most reserved of the men is guardedly optimistic. "Finally, it looks like we're going to be doing to them as they do to us." Here's another quote. "I feel like it's Christmas morning and I'm about to open my presents." And then there's comments on how easy it is to kill. Quote, "Lieutenant Fick, a Dartmouth graduate who joined the Marines in a fit of idealism, shakes his head, grinning. I'll say one thing about these guys," he says. "When we take fire, not one of them hesitates to shoot back. In World War II, when Marines hit the beaches, a surprisingly high percentage of them didn't fire their weapons, even when faced with direct enemy contact. They hesitated. Not these guys. Did you see what they did to that town? They blank destroyed it. These guys have no problem with killing." And then on another occasion, quote, Fick returns from his meeting with his superiors and gathers his team leaders for a briefing. "The bad news is we won't get much sleep tonight," he says. "The good news is we get to kill people." Here's another quote. "We've been brainwashed and trained for combat. We must say kill 3,000 times a day in boot camp. That's why it's easy." You see, in boot camp, you are taught to disregard something that God put in your heart. Also, at boot camp, you will be taught to develop brutal and destructive skills. How to bayonet a man most efficiently. How to throw an opponent off balance and kill him. And maybe to do it without much noise. Sabotage. How to destroy someone else's property. No thought of repentance or compensation. In short, you are applauded for actions that would merit imprisonment or execution in ordinary life. In boot camp, you will have evil companions. Immorality. It is rife with pornography and filthy jokes, and sailors are taken by the busload to the brothel. Bullies and thugs. I know a man who once was in the military, and he became a Christian since then, and he told me this. He said, "I joined the Marines because I wanted to kill somebody." In other words, I could kill somebody legitimately. I read a statement regarding one of the Allied commanders in the 2003 Iraq War before Baghdad fell. Quote, "This is bad boy country. I like it." End of quote. And the drill instructors you'll have at boot camp, you deliberately subject yourself to vulgarities and obscenities hurled at recruits during basic training, and the material is so vulgar, I don't want to repeat it here. On the battlefield, what'll happen? You have an unequal yoke. An unequal yoke with petty rulers. You know, the commanders of our world, the rulers, the kings, often they get in some kind of squabble with the king of some other country, and then they send their armies out toward each other. And the army is supposed to fight because these two guys can't get along. Also, fellow soldiers, you will be teaming up with men who have no moral scruples to accomplish life and death missions together. Commanders, at least 10 levels of command from private to president. It's impossible that not one of these would not be a person who hates God. And what does a recruit do? He swears to obey him and accept his orders regarding life and death missions. And somebody's going to say, well, yes, but that's just like you would refuse unethical orders from a boss in business. It is not the same. Because when you get a job, you never promise to obey all the orders of the boss. And if the boss gave an unethical command and the Christian refuses and he's fired, that's the end of it. But in the military, you would face court-martial. You've broken your vow of obedience. And in a battlefield situation, particularly, you could be shot. In other words, you cannot have insubordination on the battlefield. But what happens here, you will be doing a vain attempt to do what Jesus said is impossible. No man can serve two masters. He will either love the one and hate the other, or cling to the one and despise the other. And on the battlefield, you will have to hate Christ and cling to your earthly commander. You see, Jesus said that our love for him was to be so far above our other allegiances that our other allegiances would appear like hate by comparison. And military operations repeatedly contradict Christ's specific commands on the personal level. The result is idolatry in obeying men instead of Christ serving a national flag. Also, you will be forced by command structure into immoral actions against the enemy. You know, it means taking action that involves civilian deaths or maybe using undue severity. But then even against your own men. I read a book about World War II called Eisenhower and His Boys, and how a lower commander was required by the military hierarchy to send his men in a very dangerous mission that the objective was maybe only face-saving or political or unwise. Now, it wasn't a false mission, but you could say it wasn't a wise mission for your own troops. And yet your higher commanders, you couldn't say, well, I can't do that. So you see the kind of dilemmas people get into. Furthermore, it is impossible not to compromise Christian principles. It will be detrimental to your marriage if you join the military. Because by nature, military is your priority in life. The military says, report for duty in 24 hours, you're going to an unspecified location. And you think in your mind, I'm going to Iraq. Well, my wife doesn't want me to go to Iraq. Sorry for her. You're gone. That's how it works. You see, it is higher than your marriage commitment. And it will be destructive to your marriage. By the way, that's the reason my friend who was a medic got out. And also, it will be impossible to discern God's approval for participation in a given conflict. In the Old Testament, God clearly describes rulers and kingdoms which he used to crush other kingdoms. And observers at the time would have said, hey, this is an unjust thing that's happening. This isn't fair. And therefore, we're justified in defending ourselves. But they would actually have been fighting against God's purposes. I mean, God says, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And so it would have been unjust for Israel to go after them. Isn't that right? But later on, God says, go after them. The Amorites were evil in both stages, but only God's specific direction could make it clear when a national attack was just. God said, Assyria is a rod of my anger. That was a brutal, vicious nation. Nebuchadnezzar was rewarded by God for his work at Tyre, like I mentioned, in getting the riches of Egypt as a wage. And the citizens of Egypt could have said, this is not a just war at all. This is just greed. But you see, because we have divine revelation, we know that it was right. It's impossible also for a low-level commander to have enough information to properly evaluate whether any given action is just or not. Military commanders deliberately give only as much information to lower levels as they need to do their job. Why is that? Because if the enemy captures them, then they can't be put under pressure to divulge something they don't even know. It's a wise way of doing things. And so, the lower level commanders who are flying planes to do the firebombing of Dresden couldn't have known all the details about what was really going on and what a bad situation that really was. Participation in the military forces the Christian to compartmentalize his life between official duties and Christian actions. You know, the Christian life is everything, not just some things. It's all to God's glory, 2 Timothy 2:4. A mere secular life is not allowed for the Christian. And our weapons are not carnal. Our kingdom is not of this world. You know, if a soldier tried to simultaneously serve for two opposing armies, it wouldn't be tolerated. In fact, a good soldier and a good Christian will inevitably have a conflict of principle. What if you're a good soldier and you're leading a command of 100 men and there's a peasant with a donkey on a bridge and you're trying to get your men across that bridge? And from a military standpoint, with the enemy behind you, you've got to get across there fast. It's a dangerous situation. A good soldier is going to do what? He's going to get that peasant off the bridge no matter what and rush through there. You see the conflict? What about a medic? In some situations where a unit is surrounded, the commander might say, "We're not surrendering. We don't need medics anymore. Here's a rifle." Furthermore, modern warfare inevitably causes deaths of civilians. You know, just war theorists, they argue that it's right to kill opposing soldiers, but it's not right to kill civilians. So therefore, it's sin to kill civilians. Well, let's suppose the CIA, the intelligence agency, says those coordinates are where a military installation is. You're to take it out with a missile. And so you send that missile up there, but the coordinates were wrong. And so instead of hitting a military installation, you hit a civilian hospital. You programmed the thing. You fired it. You couldn't check on the details. You took the coordinates as correct. And somebody might claim, "Well, that's like having an accident on the highway. You didn't mean to do it." But the difference is you didn't approach a certain intersection with the intention of killing whatever was there. You see, participation in the military will incur guilt for participation in civilian deaths. And also, there will be unholy action against the individuals in the opposing army. You know, that individual in the opposing army has committed no crime, per se. He's committed nothing against you. You're just going to kill him because he's wearing the other uniform. And besides, when you kill that person, he is either a believer or he's not a believer. If he's a Christian already, you have cut short his opportunities to serve in the world and witness to other people and bless the body of Christ. And if he's not a believer, you have terminated him on this earth and ushered him into eternal damnation. That's a huge problem either way. We are to do all in the name of the Lord Jesus as if Jesus were doing it. Can you imagine Jesus taking up a machine gun and machine gunning a whole bunch of people? Most people would find that unimaginable. Participation in war also destroys goodness of character in that it wounds the conscience. Men return from war either hardened or horrified at what they've seen and done. One of the books I read regarding the Iraq War, the Americans had gone through this town and it didn't go too well for them. One of their tanks got stuck in the mud and various things went wrong and they got shot to pieces. But finally, because they had firepower available and communications, they brought reinforcements in and they turned the tide. And here's what, after that costly victory, one of the soldiers wondered two questions. If there's a God, why did he let this horrible destruction befall us? And secondly, but if there is a God, then I'm in big trouble for what I've done in this battle. Isn't that interesting that that soldier said that? Notice what's going on here. What if they had won a smashing victory against the Iraqis? Would he have wondered why God let that happen to the enemy? But I believe this illustrates there's a pervasive heart awareness that there is coming judgment for soldiers in their actions in battle. And I want to read from a quote from Chuck Horner. Chuck Horner was the Supreme Allied Air Commander in the 1991 Gulf War against Iraq. Here's what he said. He's the one who set in motion the operation against the Iraqis. Quote, setting the killing in motion, you carry a lot more responsibility, a lot more feeling of dread. It was a burden I'd been carrying around since I'd signed the orders that would start all of this carnage in motion. It was the understanding that someday I would probably have to explain my actions to God, and there was no suitable explanation. End of quote. Isn't that a shocking statement? Quote, here's another quote from him. Our fundamental strategy was simple. Blind them and beat the tar out of them as they groped about. We were going to stomp the Iraqi Air Force into submission. Not fair, not pretty, not poetic. Our goal was to be as vicious and unrelenting as possible. To do otherwise would just prolong the suffering and death. End of quote. Here's another quote by the same man. And this was after the Al-Firdis command bunker, which was being used as an air raid shelter, was hit, killing hundreds of people. Quote, certainly war can pursue noble objectives, stopping the murder, rape, and torture in Kuwait being a prime example. Certainly men and women undergoing the most stressful battlefield conditions rise to unheard-of selflessness. But war is still, when you get to the bottom line, killing, maiming, and wanton destruction. Humans at their lowest, trying to impose their will on others. War may be necessary, but it must always be detested. War is groping in the dark, trying to do dastardly things so that the war may be over with. End of quote. And the thing that makes those quotes so significant is because they come from a high-level commander. You know what war does? War contaminates the very nation who is fighting it. Let me read you another quote from one who studied war. He said this, quote, as they go through their battles, men become hardened. They have to. It is part of fighting. Murdered civilians are an awful sight at first. No one wants to have anything to do with that. Then they learn that care for enemy civilians often invites death to themselves. If there are a few snipers in an enemy town, it is easier to back up and shell the town than to go through it rooting out the snipers who take their share of our men. So war becomes increasingly ruthless. Respect for human life becomes less and less. Hard facts of time and safety demand quick, brute action. Lapses into kindheartedness postpone the end of the war and often bring more deaths to our side. The man who once felt uneasy about killing an enemy now thinks nothing of seeing 100 die. End of quote. The fundamental issue is whether or not we obey God. Now, some of you may have heard of John Calvin, and he certainly was not an Anabaptist. He certainly did not believe in non-resistance. But he made a very interesting comment, and I want to tell you about that comment. Under the direction of John Calvin, Geneva in Switzerland became a refuge for reformers and a fountainhead for missionaries fanning out all over Europe. But the Catholic countries didn't like it because it was undermining their authority and their kingdom. And so Emperor Philip II wrote to the King of France expressing his desire to help overthrow Geneva. In other words, Geneva is a problem. Let's overthrow it. The French government threatened Geneva with destruction unless those evangelists stayed home. But the evangelists poured forth unabated after the magistrates of Geneva were assured by Calvin's bold words, quote, inasmuch as the city depends upon the omnipotent God alone for protection, the highest prudence consists in the most perfect obedience to his will, end of quote. Did you catch that? Are you tired? I'll read it again. Inasmuch as the city depends upon the omnipotent God alone for protection, the highest prudence consists in the most perfect obedience to his will, end of quote. You notice, he didn't back down. He kept sending out his missionaries. Now, I want to tell you a story. If what I've said so far doesn't move your heart, I want you to listen to the story. In December 7, 1941, Mitsuo Fuchida led a force of 360 planes in a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor. So the Americans decided to mount a special attack on Tokyo. It was led by a commander named Doolittle. They needed to attack from an aircraft carrier far from Japan and would not have enough fuel to turn back to the carrier after they were done bombing. So they would fly over China until they ran out of fuel and then parachute, hopefully, to safety. There was an American named Jacob DeShazer who was inflamed with hatred against the Japanese And so he was glad to participate in this dangerous mission. However, he and his crew members had the misfortune of parachuting into a place in China that was held by the Japanese. They were beaten, tortured, half-starved. They were held in solitary confinement. And after 6 months, three of the crew members were executed by a firing squad. And 14 months later, one of the men died of slow starvation. And De Schazer was so filled with hatred that he nearly went crazy. But he began to wonder, why do human beings hate each other so much? He had heard that Christianity changed hatred to love. And he felt a strange desire to read the Bible. He begged his captors for a Bible, and when they finally gave him one, they said, you could have it for only 3 weeks. He immersed himself in it and became a Christian, a new creation in Christ, June 8, 1944. His bitter hatred was changed to loving pity for the very men who tortured him and his companions. On August 20, 1945, paratroopers came in and liberated the prison. And De Schazer went back to America, regained his health, studied in a Bible college, and returned to Japan as a missionary. He wrote up his story in a tract and preached to thousands of people. One day, a young woman whose fiancé had been killed in Doolittle's raid. Now, you remember, Doolittle's raid was the one that De Schazer went on. She came to his meeting determined to kill him in revenge. And she got converted instead. Well, after Pearl Harbor, Mitsuo Fuchida flew in many more raids. He became one of Japan's most highly regarded pilots. He was at the fatal battle of Midway. Now, Midway is where the Japanese incurred losses from which they never recovered. But instead of flying that day at that battle, Fuchida was below decks recovering from appendicitis. But he didn't want to be down there when his men were up there flying. And so with great effort, even though he was in bad shape, he left his sick bed and worked to get up on deck with his men. And he was injured up there on deck. But he escaped from being trapped below in the burning and sinking ship. Fuchida was in Hiroshima the day before the atomic bomb was dropped, but he was suddenly called to go to Tokyo for a meeting, and so he escaped. And after the war, there was no use for his services as a fighter pilot. He went home and tried to farm, but he was discouraged and disillusioned. One day, he got off the train and was handed a tract by an American. It was entitled, "I Was a Prisoner of Japan." It was De Schazer's story. Fuchida could not explain the transformation of that man, nor could he forget it. Since the American had gotten the answer from the Bible, he decided to buy one for himself, despite his Buddhist heritage. He was particularly gripped by Luke 23:34. Jesus' prayer at the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Jesus had most certainly prayed that for him. He gave his heart to Christ. Fuchida and De Schazer traveled together all over Japan, preaching to thousands of the love of Christ. May God bless you.